Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guest today is Anchorage healthcare analyst Mark Foster. Our topic will be a UAA Institute of Social and Economic Research report recently on Alaska healthcare costs. We've been addressing the issue of healthcare costs with a number of recent programs, and this one is focused more on what's going on right here in Alaska. How do we compare on costs and outcomes? You can reach us with questions or comments during the next hour at any time. In Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. Write that down, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And we have an email address during the next hour for questions and comments. Line one, you have to spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line one at alaskapublic.org. Mark, welcome to Line One. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
There is a feeling among many people, physicians, insurers, payers, that we pay a lot more for healthcare in Alaska. So that's kind of the reason for you being asked to be here. And you, with some other individuals, have looked into this with some great depths. Would you tell us a little bit about ICER first, and then let's see how you guys addressed this issue and what you found?
Sure. I had the good fortune of working with Scott Goldsmith, Rosalind Frazier, and Matt Berman, and we had support from Fran Ulmer looking at the cost of healthcare in Alaska in 2005. And then most recently with the State of Alaska Healthcare Commission, we've updated our report for 2010. And really we're trying to get a feel for what's sort of the total spend in Alaska, what are the cost trends, and what are we getting for those that spending, and how do we compare to other places? And that was the puzzle we were trying to solve.
Why would that be important?
I think ultimately we want to understand what kind of value we're getting for the spending, and particularly in healthcare, where annual cost growth is frequently 9%, well above inflation, what potential crowding out of other spending might be occurring, and are we really getting good value for that rapid rate of growth in spending?
So healthcare costs in the country, and we're going to hear about it in the United States, are growing very, very fast, and faster than gross domestic product is growing. And so what I hear you saying, we're having less and less to give to education, to social programs, to have left for defense, and paying our debt.
All of those things. And the question, you know, comes down to, can we afford to spend more on healthcare? And one of the things to keep in mind is, as our incomes grow, we frequently do take a larger portion of our income and devote it to healthcare and education. So perhaps not unsurprisingly, the two areas, if you look across the economy where you have continuous rapid growth in expenditures that are greater than overall inflation, are healthcare. And if you look carefully at secondary education, private university education, you'll see their private tuitions mm-hmm. growing up at rates that are almost comparable to healthcare mm-hmm. spending. Mm-hmm. So as incomes do increase, people do tend to spend on those high-value things. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the question is, are we really getting high value for those expenditures?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got a lot of questions about that, but let's get back to the basics. How much are we spending in Alaska on healthcare? And then you have to put that in some perspective.
Sure. Roughly, we think we're spending about $7.5 billion in annual spend on health care, which includes the net cost of health insurance, hospitals, physicians, nurses, prescription drugs, dental services, and those kinds of things. And if I look at Alaska per capita health spending as a percentage of our income that we have as households, one of the things you find is 1990, we're roughly comparable with many of the western states, somewhere around 9 to 10% of our per capita income was personal health care expenditures. 2010, for many of the western states, that's grown into about 14 or 15%. So 14 or 15% of the your income is going to healthcare expenditures sort of in total. If I look at Alaska, that number is about 22%. So we've gone from being in the middle of the pack now from being well above and leading the pack in terms of spending per capita.
So my next question is are we in an increasing rate? There's some evidence in the U.S., as I understand it, that the rate of growth, and it's still growing, is slowing, and perhaps to the slowest rate it's been in a number of years. But I'm not sure I hear that for Alaska.
Well, I think it has slowed. And certainly there's been a recent presentation before the legislature by the state of Alaska looking at their cost growth going from a 9% annual rate to a 7.9%. So there's a slowing, but it's not particularly dramatic if I compare it to inflation, which is fairly low. Mm-hmm. So it's still growing faster than inflation considerably.
So per capita income, we're spending about 20%, almost a quarter of what we spend on healthcare.
Right. And keep in mind that that's spending, you know, individuals out of pocket, their health insurance coverage,
that's everything, yeah.
Federal programs, mm-hmm. It's the whole package.
Mm-hmm. So, what's growing the most? what's driving? I mean, there's a couple of questions there. Where are we spending most of our money, and then what's driving most of the cost?
A lot of what we spend are physician services and hospital care, and that's where a lot of the action is. And if you look across the population, easily half the population might be spending on average $300 a year. It's that other half of the distribution who go in and have medications, go in and have surgery, cancer, heart, those kinds of things where you get much higher numbers in terms of per person spending. And so on any given year, maybe 5% of the population drives about 50% of that cost.
So the median and the mean are very different. The mean is one thing. The median tells you where things are slanted. And what you're saying is in any one year, there are a lot of people who are generating a lot of the healthcare costs. And the next question I'd have is, well, is it the same group of people each year? I mean, sometimes it's just unfortunate. You're hit by a drunk driver, you develop a cancer, and so it may be different people in each year. Is that necessarily true?
Yes. As a general proposition, it is different people from year to year. And even those who have chronic conditions don't tend to be in that most peaked portion of the curve where you've got, you know, surgeries frequently that are happening every year. So you get, you know, per, you know, what do we get? Roughly the top 5% of the spend in any given year is approaching $40,000 per person in that top 5%. So they're getting touched by a surgeon typically.
And you used the number $300. Was that just an example, or is that typical of...
That's pretty typical of the U.S. patterns.
So it's really skewed towards, in any one year, there are individuals who are... okay, so...
Cancers and hearts and orthopedic surgery are the sort of the dominant pieces.
Uh-huh. And again, it may not be the same people. It may be some unfortunate individuals, but that's where things start happening and expense. And it's not necessarily the premature infants either, or is that? I mean, because that's another area where you often hear things talked about.
You do see some cost growth there, but if I look at on a per year, per patient cost, and I'm looking at births, the numbers there are not much different than 20-year-olds when I'm averaging it across the entire population. Mm-hmm. So those costs aren't particularly high, but as I'm sure you're aware, on a per-case basis, you can find extraordinary costs where heroic measures are taken to save babies.
Who is paying the bills? Where does the money that we're spending, this $7.5 billion most recently per year, where's that money coming from?
In the end, it's coming from a combination of out-of-pocket insurance paid for by employers, insurance paid for by employees, And ultimately, we all pay for that in taxes and in our household spending. And so that's really where it's coming from. If I look at Alaska in particular, I think some characteristics are interesting to note. About $3 billion of that $7.5 billion is employer-sponsored care, which is to say federal, state, local, and private employers. It's about what they're spending on insurance, and in turn, that's covering the care. Another $3 billion are a combination of federal, state, and local programs, Medicare, Medicaid, the VA, Indian Health Service, and a host of other programs, community health centers. So there's $3 billion and $3 billion. And the other basically billion, billion and a half, you're looking at directly purchased stuff out of pocket and services that people are paying for directly.
You know, a question that just came to my mind is there similar times in the U.S. history or in world history that are like this, where suddenly there's huge, expensive, draining, increasing amounts of disposable income, whatever the economic term is, but leaving less and less. I mean, my first thought as I answer my own question would be during a war, you're spending a lot. So what I'm getting at is, what's the natural history of this? How does this end for countries that are doing this? Is there a soft landing?
I guess the short answer is I don't know. A couple of observations. One, as a percentage of the GDP, 1970s, 1980s, the U.S. wasn't very different than the other developed countries. Now we're clearly breaking out from that pack in terms of how much we're spending as a proportion of our economy. Now, if I go back in time and look at the distribution of health care costs that we were just talking about, 5% of the patients driving about 50% of the cost, that's a relatively stable distribution of costs going back for decades. So it's not unusual to find that a few people do have most of the activity in any given year. That hasn't changed even with new technology and sort of new services and cost growth. That distribution is surprisingly robust.
Yep. Okay. Well, there's a caller, and I want to take that call. I've got some other questions that leads me to, but let me have Bill. Bill, you're on line one. Let's see what you want to ask.
You're talking about the drivers. Good show, by the way, again. You're talking about the drivers of people, not going to basically 5% of the people causing 50% of the thing. A lot of people who are sick, a lot of men in particular, guys with like GERD and stuff, they won't go to the doctor. Okay, so that leads up to a crisis later on. But the way the deductible is set up now, your first $500 you have to pay. Has anybody ever had it to where you didn't pay until you spent $1,000 and then you'd have to pay after that? So in other words, you wouldn't have to pay the first $500. That would drive people to go to the doctor sooner than if they had to come up with money. Has anybody ever thought about turning that around?
I think you'll find Rand did an experiment, I want to say in the 1970s, and looked at different designs on deductibles to see how that would motivate basically participation. And I just don't recall, I haven't looked at the numbers most recently enough to look at that, but that would be where I'd go and start digging to see if I could answer that question quantitatively.
Thank you.
What's the largest single cost in the state of Alaska? Let's ask that question.
I think there's a couple different ways to look at it. One is by program, and Medicaid is the largest sort of single program. But when you split it apart, you'll see that it has a lot of different programs. And so in some ways, it's an arbitrary sort of look at it. I think one way to think about it is the largest single cost is people. What are we spending the money on? We're spending the money on people providing care to other people. And that's what we're doing. And the sort of the next cost that goes with that are all the technology that they are working with to help provide you with modern care.
Now, I know in some of the national data or reports that I've seen is that the new technologies, and that's a broad thing, topic by itself, is the single leading cause. It's not the end of life. It's not early life. It's not the aging population. It's the technologies, the newer drugs that are being used to treat cancer or some of the chronic diseases, and the newer surgery techniques and so forth, even though some of the new surgical techniques are getting people out of the hospital quicker and faster. So it's really difficult. But that seems to be one of the big ones, or the big one consistently right now.
Yeah, and if we look back across the last three, four, even five decades, it's fairly clear that what's driving cost growth, roughly half of that cost growth is technology-driven, new technologies and new services. About 30% of that cost growth is related to income. As our incomes get higher, we buy more health care services. About 10% of the cost growth is attributed to having insurance coverage that covers a lot of things, so you don't have that first dollar sort of incentive to deal with. And then the other 10% is sort of the other sort of things that we aren't quite sure what all they are, but there are a bunch of them in there.
So Alaska is, to kind of summarize so far, where our healthcare costs are going up. Maybe it seems like faster than the national. Is that what I heard you say, the national average, or am I misunderstanding that?
I think our cost growth is slightly higher than the national average, and I frequently find evidence that that's because we're catching up to the lower 48 in terms of importing specialists, because we didn't have that specialty available here.
Ah.
So, you know, do you want to make an adjustment for that or not? Because it's not the same service set. So as we increase our services, our cost growth is accelerating a little bit faster than the lower 48. We just have this lag. And I think that's partly what's happening if we're looking at sort of cost growth versus cost growth.
So what you're saying is when you're looking at cost growth, you better compare apples with apples, not a newborn apple with a mature apple, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
Okay. How about our absolute cost compared to Seattle? That's an issue that seems to have raised its head a lot recently.
Yeah. If we look at the price per service and look at physician services, we typically see pediatrics at maybe a 40% price premium for the same service. Cardiology might be 80-85% price premium. Other subspecialties may be higher than that. And the Milliman study that was done for the Alaska Healthcare Commission has a sort of a lot of breakdown in information. That gives you a sense. We're paying a premium there in the physician services area, probably in aggregate in that 60 to 70% price premium. If I look at facilities, that premium might be a third, 33, 34, 35%.
By facilities, you mean
hospitals? The hospital facilities, clinics, and those arrangements.
Let me remind our listeners at this point, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Mark Foster. He's a healthcare analyst here in Anchorage. And he's one of the authors of the Institute of Social and Economic Research report on Alaska healthcare costs. And we've been looking at that information and sharing it with you. If you've got questions or comments about healthcare costs in Alaska or nationally, please don't hesitate to give us a call. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. And we do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Outcomes have also been looked at more recently, and at least compared to many countries in the world, the U.S. Outcomes, again, there's lots of ways to look at it, but overall seem to not be staying at the level that they used to be. So that the common information I see is that our health care costs are greater and our results are what we get for that spending is less than comparable countries. Can we say that about Alaska, or do we know that information?
We have some information, but I would say it's primarily correlations rather than causal. So we want to first sort of caution against reading too much into it. But it's quite clear that over the last decade, we've made a number of improvements in outcome measures in Alaska. Rate of occupational fatalities, the prevalence of smoking, infant mortality, infectious disease, all those rates we've made good progress on. Frequently, that's public health sort of driven things as opposed to the hospital and doctor sort of infrastructure that provides service. But nonetheless, they are part of the system. So there's definitely some benefits there. The other big outcome change that's a positive is basically deaths from heart disease have gone down, and we've made really good progress on treating hearts and sort of all the sort of span of things and complications that come out of that. And in fact, Alaska in some ways has done slightly better than the national average over the last 10 to 20 years on some of those metrics. So there's a slight incremental benefit that we're seeing here, and that's after we age adjust. So, you know, is that the healthcare providers? Is there some self-selection in terms of the population and their outdoor activity, their diet and exercise? Who knows? But we are getting slightly better results.
Yeah, it's surprising. I saw for a number of years now, cancer death rates have been decreasing. Also, incidence have been decreasing. So it's not just high-quality care. There's something also going on, despite a aging population, which is the biggest risk factor for cancer, but for heart disease as well.
Yeah, and I've been age-adjusting sort of the stuff I'm looking at, so I'm trying to take that factor out so I can really isolate on what's happening.
All right, we've got a couple more callers. Let's take those. Heather, you're on line one.
Thank you. Why is there such resistance among both insurance companies and companies themselves in their policy to paying for preventive care? It seems to me in the long run that not only pays for itself, but it brings costs down significantly. And specifically, I would note, and not all policies, but huge policies in this state won't pay for immunizations, colonoscopies, or contraception.
At least looking across the companies I've looked at and the trends I've seen an increase in wellness programs, an increase in prevention spending, which isn't to say that there are some laggards in the population, but the overall trend I've seen toward increasing spend on prevention, and I think there may be a few who are sort of standing outside of that trend, but that's mostly what I'm seeing when I'm looking across larger employers. And there's certainly a lag for the smaller employers who are continuing to sort of look very hard at the spend side and are struggling with what they can afford if they don't have an immediate payback.
Federal regulations require that most well-established, good evidence-based immunization practices have to be covered, is my understanding. But my next thought would be, unfortunately, more and more people are not having health insurance coverage, is my understanding. So the federal government, or at least Obama's plan, was to at least address some of that, but it may not work because of the difficulty and costs of just getting health care.
I guess I would be very specific, and because I asked part of this question a few weeks ago when you were on, that unless you exhibit very specific risk factors or have very specific problems, the state health insurance, which covers, of course, all state employees, retirees, et cetera, and I believe it covers teachers as well, or at least retired teachers, won't pay for a screening colonoscopy, which, you know, it's if someone mm-hmm. gets mm-hmm. colon cancer, you're talking mm-hmm. about a whole lot more money. So it seems to me extremely short-sighted, and I wonder if you have any insight into why they have made that determination.
Yeah, good, and I don't know how they can, if that's necessarily outside of the federal law or not, but and can they skirt that? Mark, do you have any thoughts about
that? I don't
have
any direct knowledge. I can't.
Yeah. So, Heather, I mean, at least from my point of view, it seems to be funny and hard to explain. I don't know their side of it.
Okay, thank you for trying at least.
I think I remember your call earlier before about the same thing, and I think it is an important issue. And I'm trying to think about what the federal regulations are now about preventative services like colonoscopy and so forth. I don't know it off the top of my head like I do immunization, so I apologize for that.
I really appreciate your continuing to assure the public that immunizations are very smart, very wise, and very responsible.
Well, there's certainly, yeah, it's hard to argue, although there are obviously people who do, as being one of the most... the best policies that have ever been dreamed up by humans and one of the most cost effective. So, at least immunizations should be covered, it seems to me, most of them.
Thank you very much.
You bet. All right. Bob, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Mark, as a former public utilities commissioner, I just wondered to what extent the high market concentration and the health insurance market is a factor in health insurance costs in Alaska or health insurance services, health services.
I haven't had a chance to do any reasonably robust regression analysis to go, okay, let's look at sort of the concentration in the market here, compare it to the concentration in other markets, and just see how tight that might be in Alaska. Having said that, there's certainly national data to suggest that the nature and extent of the competition in any particular market will have a measurable effect on the margins that might be there.
Thank you.
All right. We quickly got to about halfway through. Mark, I think at this point I'm going to take our midsection break, and then we'll come back to questions and comments, both from the listeners and myself. Let me remind everyone, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll return to take any calls and emails as we discuss healthcare costs in Alaska with Mark Foster. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, we're talking with Anchorage healthcare analyst and co-author of the UAA ICER report on healthcare costs in Alaska, Mark Foster. If you've got questions or comments over the next 30 minutes, you can email them to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us directly at 550-8433, and our outside toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday nights, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we won't be able to answer questions and comments that come in at that particular time. Mark, you've mentioned that healthcare costs are growing. We've talked a little bit about who's paying for them and some of the principal reasons for that. Is that changing who is paying for healthcare, the increasing growing costs?
There's certainly been some shifts from employers to employees, and so the most immediate effect of cost growth, certainly over the last few decades and likely going forward, is that as a percentage of employee compensation, healthcare costs are taking a bigger and bigger bite, which has the effect of reducing cash compensation. So wage growth has moderated as healthcare costs have grown. And so that's frequently when you're looking at the margin between, does somebody want to take insurance or do they want to forego insurance? They're frequently making a judgment about how much cash wage do I want versus how much insurance do I want.
We've you've fleshed out the idea that growing technology, new technology, seems to be in both nationally and locally one of the biggest drivers of healthcare, increasing healthcare costs. But let's flesh out a couple of more that are commonly brought up as or appear to be drivers of increasing costs.
Yeah, no, new tech's probably about 50% of the cost driver. Income's the other one. Insurance coverage is one. Now, when I look at that last 10%, it's frequently demographics and sort of a shift in the population aging. So it's a factor, but it might be really only about 10% of the cost growth differential when you look at the total picture.
You were saying insurance cost. You mean administrative overhead, or what do you mean?
The presence of insurance helps drive basically additional costs in the system because people don't have to pay for that first dollar, and it just enables effectively more people to participate without them paying directly, and they tend to use more of the service as a result.
Is that true of home insurance and car insurance? One of my questions here is, you know, is this really insurance? We call it insurance, but it seems different to me. I mean, if you look up insurance and to pay for expenses that you can't afford to have hit you, like your house burning down or a car accident.
Yeah, and there's certainly an element of health insurance packages that I think meet that traditional definition. If the health insurance covers all your expenses, I think then it starts differing from that traditional thing. And if you don't have any dollar cost associated with it, then frequently you'll consume more of a free good. And and I think that's one of the challenges we face is where do we draw that line about where does it become insurance versus where is there an out-of-pocket cost? And I think there's a great deal of difference in the marketplace in terms of people's tolerance for risk and how they might buy it compared to where you might set it if you're trying to establish a large program.
Is there any significant increase in costs in Alaska based on our location, the physical characteristics, large state, and our past history with huge inflation, as I recall, associated with the growth of the oil pipelines? Are those important factors?
I think they all play into the puzzle. When I look at overall costs and I try and sort of separate out what's partly to driving that higher cost for facilities and the higher cost for physician and personal services, what I find frequently is we're paying a wage premium to healthcare providers who are in specialties. We're not paying much of a premium for nursing, for example, relative to other markets. So there's a differential there. But the other thing that we're doing in addition to paying for a premium is the productivity per person tends to be lower. We have more time off. We have more part-time workers, more sort of seasonal work. And so if I look at that annual wage package for a healthcare provider, that's frequently only producing, you know, maybe 1,500 hours of output as opposed to maybe 1,800 or 1,900 in the lower 48. So the combination of the wage premium and less work over the course of the year creates the higher cost profile, if you will, for people.
And that, I would argue, that may not necessarily be bad because in that provider thing, what you're saying is providers here might spend more time per patient. They're maybe not out fishing and hunting, but the number of patients seen per time. And then there is some reason to think, compared to very high volumes situations outside, that this might be better.
Yeah, and there's certainly a number of practitioners who I think can make the claim that not only are they providing better service and a higher quality service, they're doing it fairly cost effectively. But that's, when I look across the entire sort of data set, it's not clear to me that may necessarily be the case.
Okay. Let's take a call. Ted, you're on line one.
Thank you, Doctor. A quick comment and then a question for Mark. Comment in response to your earlier caller who was talking about colorectal screening. I just wanted to mention to you and to your audience that we have a bill pending in the legislature right now. It's House Bill 275 that would provide colorectal screening for retirees. The bill is being held in committee right now, and the Commissioner of the Department of Administration testified on it last week, basically indicating that the state of Alaska wanted to do a more comprehensive review of preventive care measures, including colorectal screening for retirees, and asked the committee to put the bill on hold. The complexity for retirees has a lot to do with the there's a constitutional requirement for retirement and benefit issues that does not allow what's referred to as diminishment. It does not allow the state to diminish those benefits. And so as a result, maintaining balance in those programs seems to be a complicated issue. So I just wanted to mention that. My question for Mark is, there seems to be a trend now in the insurance industry where, because of the high cost here in Alaska, that insurance companies are actually offering patients the opportunity to leave the state, go to Seattle typically, for services. My wife's company recently sent out a notice saying that for certain procedures, they would make that benefit available that would provide not only travel expenses for the patient, but for a caregiver as well, including per diems, et cetera. Do you think that's going to catch on, and will it likely have an impact on competitive issues in terms of medical services being provided here in Alaska?
I think the short answer is yes. There's always been, at least in my mind, at least for the last 20 years, among higher income and people who have sort of more generous travel budgets, the prospect for traveling outside to care. I think that trend will increase as the price differentials, if they continue to increase on the trend line they're on, I think we'll see more sort of insurance companies responding to the pressure they're getting from employers and making that available. And certainly I have anecdotal evidence out of the Kenai Peninsula sort of population that more and more of the North Slope working population is taking advantage of flights to places like Asia to get health care there for joint replacement.
Thank you.
I just you always want to keep an open mind about risks and benefits. I've often wondered myself as why insurance companies aren't doing this, to be honest with you. But one argument against it would be for surgical procedures, the follow-up becomes difficult. And from a surgeon standpoint in Alaska, the patient goes out, gets some surgery, comes into the emergency room with a problem. They don't really want to get involved in somebody else's problem. And so I think it's fair to keep that in mind. And then what's the cost of getting that patient back down there, and who's doing the follow-up? And although I think it's reasonable to suspect that the costs and money's going to win out and that the insurance companies are going to do more of this. It just seems reasonable to me, but there are some problems with it. And the whole issue of medical tourism, as I would call it, to going out of state and out of country for care, obviously has some risk as well as benefits. We need to kind of make sure we're aware of. We've thought about trying to do that on this program to address that. I just have a hard time finding experts who can give me the right kind of information on that. So if anyone's got ideas on experts that can help me understand the risks and benefits of medical tourism, I'd be interested in knowing about it. Let's go to another caller. Ruth, you're on line one.
Yes, this is Ruth DeGraff from Eagle River. And I would like to ask you if you've ever been sick or needed a dentist on a Friday in Alaska. I'm hard put to find very many doctors that work more than 4 days a week, or dentists either. And I'm wondering how this impacts the cost of health care in this state.
Okay.
I think the short answer, sort of circling back to a prior bit of analysis that I did, was that overall, the health care providers in Alaska don't work as many hours as healthcare providers in lower 48 when I'm comparing sort of state-to-state averages or state-to national averages. And so our typical output here might be 80 to 85% of what a full-time equivalent person is doing in somewhere else. So that becomes a factor that contributes to slightly higher costs.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was my opinion as well. I just wanted to hear what you say about it. Thank you.
Okay. Let me ask one other question. We've ferreted out that costs are higher here, that depending on how you look at it, our rate of increase in costs are at least comparable than other places. But what about the bottom line? Are hospitals more profitable? And I want to throw in there, I don't care if you're a nonprofit or profit, are they more profitable? Are physicians more profitable? Are insurance companies more profitable than those in other states? So, you know, that's to me an important thing to try to understand.
Yeah, I would say the Alaska Healthcare Commission Milliman study points out that there are certainly, from their work, higher profit margins that are being paid in this market compared to other markets. The challenge I think we have is to discern how much of that higher margin is required to attract and retain subspecialists to a sort of a small remote market versus how much of that is basically above and beyond what would be required to attract and retain those particular specialties if we want to have them locally. I'm kind of reminded of a lunch conversation I had not too many months ago out in the Matsu Valley where I was having lunch with a multi-generation family who, you know, ran a small business. And the current president of the company was about 50 years old, basically said, yeah, the healthcare costs are too expensive. We're paying a premium for a lot of these specialists. We don't need them. And the retired mother of the person who was at lunch, she said, well, it's about time we got those specialists here so I can stay here in Alaska and enjoy my grandchildren. So I think, you know, there's a lot of trade-offs we have to think about, and it really does depend on what perspective you're starting with, you know, whether you're paying them directly when you're developing budgets or whether you're a retiree and you want to have those services available so you can stay close to your kids. Mm-hmm. So I think, there's no right answer. It really does depend on where you're starting from.
Patrick, you're on line one.
Good morning. Well, afternoon, I guess, Dr. Woodard. I had a couple of comments and a couple of questions. As a pediatrician, I don't know if you've read the American Academy of Pediatrics policy statement on early childhood adversity and toxic stress, but I know that the Adverse Childhood Experience Study relates childhood trauma and childhood stress to later negative health outcomes, and yet we have not focused on dealing with toxic stress much in Alaska. The second comment and question is that medical institutions outside of the state of Alaska, including Virginia Mason, Seattle Children's Hospital, Theta Care, a number of institutions are utilizing the management model known as lean healthcare, not only in its medical practice, but in its administrative structure, which, from what I see looking at healthcare institutions here in Alaska, huge administrative structures to deal with the delivery of healthcare. But was there any consideration or look taken in the study, Mark, about the application of lean healthcare within Alaska or administrative and process improvements and the addressing of adverse childhood experiences and toxic stress?
No, we didn't penetrate to that level of detail. Though I will share with you, it appears to me that on a sort of a supply basis, we do appear to have relatively high administrative overheads, both on the insurance side compared to other states and on the healthcare provisioning side. Part of it, I think, is due to a lot of different programs and a lot of different sort of paperwork over a very small population, and part of it may be due to a relatively fragmented health delivery system.
And Dr. Woodard, any comments on the early childhood adversity or the toxic stress?
Yeah, I think this is an excellent point. It's
it's really, I think, important, and I think it gets to the issue that Stephen Brodzinski, I hope I'm giving his name right, the guy from the University of Washington, who's been on the program a couple of times in the last month or so, and his point is differentiating health from health care, and health is outside to a large degree of the realm of health care. We're spending more money on health care. There's not much evidence we're getting a lot of more health because of it. And so when you start talking about toxic stress and the issues that happen from a social milieu standpoint that affects our children, which has now been associated with health outcomes, again, that's outside of the healthcare issue. I think it's a very important public health issue. I don't think people are as well aware of it, but the Academy of Pediatrics, as you well noted, is looking at this pretty extensively. Does that make sense to you? I just want everybody to understand what you're talking about there in a little bit greater detail.
Yeah, it would make sense to me, but I've not heard much discussion about either in the state of Alaska, although right. I've been advocating that we right. have those discussions in a more public forum, including the governor's task force on health care costs.
You know, an example would be the early childhood intervention programs that have really been shown to be pretty doggone cost-effective from an educational standpoint. And I don't know that we've looked at it from a health care cost standpoint, but it seems to likely make good sense.
Well, I see a lot of silos, and I think hospitals and healthcare practices are silos. Really should be communicating with the substance abuse programs, with the tobacco cessation programs, a lot more effectively than happens today. Anyway, thank you very much.
Yep. Patrick, I can't help but want to comment also on that. There's a movement certainly afoot to have medical homes especially in pediatrics, and our many other practices, including our own, are now moving towards a medical home model so that we can address hopefully a little bit more better some of these social issues and help families at least get to the right resources. And so some of that is being addressed, certainly in the Department of Pediatrics realm of things.
All right. Thanks much.
You bet. Let me just move towards just briefly in our last couple of minutes about answers, which I'm sure Mark has got lots of good answers for. But anyway, here is Dr. Relman, who is a past editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm kind of paraphrasing, but he actually invented the term medical industrial complex in the 1980s. And he basically said anybody in this medical industrial complex should not be for profit. No other country has a for-profit medical system. And his belief is that this is the primary source of U.S. excessive costs in healthcare. That is that for-profit organizations drive for profit. The bottom line is the problem, and even not-for-profit hospitals are driven to look at the bottom line and not to be part of a social service network with community and social responsibilities. Basically saying no one who should be trying to make a profit from someone's illness. We talked about this before we came on the air. I like your comments because to me there's a social responsibility issue that perhaps has been lost from medicine. Is a not-for-profit healthcare organization like everybody else does in the world part of our answer?
It might be. But let me just sort of step back and at least the evidence that I've been able to discern. One, we clearly pay higher prices for a more complex system, and the question becomes then what benefits do we get for it? Many outcome measures, the U.S. doesn't do particularly well compared to the other developed countries. But on some outcome measures, we do markedly better, particularly on cancers. Prostate cancer comes to mind. And so there are some outcomes where we do see some additional benefit for the incremental cost. And there's at least some argument that the research component that is part of our costs is also sort of spread, if you will, and the benefits go out to the other countries and are captured there. Having said that, there's probably a lot of additional efficiency that can be gained from the existing system. Many of the providers in the U.S. who are looking at reordering their system of health care delivery and frequently bundling that with health insurance are even looking at cutting one out of three people out of their delivery system process from beginning to end, because they think a lot of what's happened is it's just become more complex. And if they really simplify their system and let people focus on care, they can in fact reduce costs overall by being more efficient. Now, whether that's something that will be driven by for-profits or nonprofits, I think ultimately it will be driven by competition between for-profit and nonprofit systems as resources become tighter, the federal government spend on healthcare gets reduced, and employees and employers go, can we really afford to be spending 7, 8, 9% per year on health insurance year over year, because it's beginning to stagnate wages? So I think all those forces will come together, and you'll see competition between for-profit and nonprofit systems, and we'll see which one does better.
Why hasn't that happened yet? I mean, to me, the middle class is getting really squeezed, not only by the healthcare, but as you mentioned, college costs are doing exactly the same thing. I interviewed Uwe Reinhardt from Princeton several years ago, and I said by now the middle class would be screaming. I don't see anybody screaming. I mean, we're feeling it, but we can't get anything changed, it seems like. So we're finally at that point where competition and less payments are going to force us to make the changes that are necessary.
I think the change is occurring in markets across the country. And certain smaller markets, not probably as much. But in larger markets, and in some cases in medium-sized markets where there's sort of a collaboration between the providers of healthcare, the doctors, the hospitals, the employers who are paying for health insurance, the insurance companies, and some patient representatives, I think you'll see there's evidence that they are reorganizing their systems and providing higher value care. And ultimately, by focusing on value and quality, they're driving the cost down, as it turns out, and eliminating errors and basically duplication and things that aren't needed. And I think those are the most successful places where they're getting that collaboration.
You think that's a significant factor in why our growth of healthcare costs has slowed?
No, I think that's largely due to the economy here in the last few years.
Yeah. So even though you think that's where we're going, you're not saying that we see much evidence on the big scale of effects of that yet?
And those successful smaller and mid-sized market innovations don't appear to have scaled up and out across the country yet.
Okay. Julia, you're on line one. Let me just remind you, we've only got about 4 or 5 minutes left.
That's okay. I won't need that. I just wondered if Mr. Foster has ever had the personal pleasure of living in countries that have better healthcare systems. In particular, I was thinking of Norway or Australia, where I lived, and I would just like to add that in Australia, not only were we patients extremely happy with our healthcare there, but also my Australian doctor said that he would find practicing medicine in America unbearable because it would bother him to be working in a system where, you know, people, where the leading cause of bankruptcy is medical expenses.
Right.
So I'll take my answer off the air.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I would mention my understanding is Australia has one of the better outcomes for price ratios. Mark?
Yeah, there's certainly other countries are doing very well relative to the U.S. in terms of their spend per the size of the economy, the percentage of the GDP that's being spent, and the quality across most, if not most of the dimensions, they're doing quite well. But there are a few quality dimensions where at least the U.S. system can suggest that there are some things that we're doing in cancer care that may be better than what you're finding in most of the other countries. But there's certainly a lot of good results being achieved in other countries.
Yeah, it always depends on what endpoint you're looking at, and then most of these national
our worldwide examples we're giving are overall values, but there's pockets of good care. Canada's actually thought of as being very good, except people don't, they wait for procedures. So that's the downside there. And but Australia has been up on my radar a little bit more recently. I wish I understood more of how they do things. We just got about 2 minutes left. Mark, this is a time when I like to kind of summarize. Let's go back over again. What are the important points we want people to remember about what we've talked about today?
I think that the challenge we face when we sort of look at the healthcare cost equation really turns around and becomes a question about value. What are we getting for the money that we're spending? And when we focus on quality and we focus on collaboration and get people really focused on that, we tend to drive efficiencies through the system. We tend to eliminate duplication, and we're tending to get better cost results. If we focus exclusively on cost going into the conversation, we tend to get everyone's back up, and they get to worried about bottom lines, and it becomes a defensive conversation. I think to the extent we can shift the conversation toward value and quality, we frequently see better results.
I would also mention on our website, alaskapublic.org, there's several links, and one that you could follow for more information. One that's particularly good was T.R. Reid has a recent public broadcasting system program that addresses the American healthcare system, the good news, and he talks about systems that, like Mark is implying, have developed, one in Grand Junction, Colorado, one in Seattle, and I actually forget where the other one is, but there are examples of where people have pulled together to provide high-quality health care at a good price, and I think that's what I'm hearing you say, and that we really need to be done. The VA system has been another one, and also I would say my understanding is Alaska Native Medical Center has done a good job, and in many of these, physicians are employees, I might point out, versus separate independent practitioners, where it may be more difficult to do some of the things we're talking about. Final comments?
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I think this is helpful bits of information to get everybody thinking about where we need to be going. I think we all agree something has to be done to change the cost escalations for healthcare in this country. Thanks for being here, Mark.
Thank you.
Let me remind everybody that you can continue today's conversation on KSKA by going to alaskapublic.org and looking for the link to Facebook. And you can join us next week when we will be discussing multiple sclerosis. Our guest will be Mo Hillstrand, a nurse practitioner who deals only with neurologic problems. Anita Fowler, who is director of the Alaska Multiple Sclerosis Center, and Jessica Henning, the program coordinator of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, the Greater Northwest Chapter. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, April 9th, here on FM 91.1. Pat Yack is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and helped us with calls and emails today. Thanks for listening, especially for those of you who called and emailed in. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.